Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Emily Means. I'm filling in for Roger McDonough today. And today on the program, founders of the Salt Lake Comic Convention, FanX, come under fire for their response to sexual harassment allegations. At a meeting of its state central committee, the Utah Republican Party removes some of its women and minority members, and LDS church leaders meet with the NAACP. Those stories, plus your underplayed stories of the week and more. And joining me for this conversation, I'm so excited to have this group of fresh faces here in the studio. We've got Sean P. Means, digital life reporter at the Salt Lake Tribune. Sean, thanks so much for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Happy to have you. Also, religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack. Peggy, you got a mic in front of you. We're good to go?
Yep.
Good. I'm glad that you're here. We've also got politics reporter Lee Davidson. Good morning, Lee.
Good morning.
And columnist Holly Richardson to shed a little bit of editorial light on some of these stories. Hi, Holly.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Remember, you can join us with your thoughts, questions, and comments by calling 801-355-8255. Sean Means.
Hello.
Excited to have you here because we are both geeks.
Yes.
And I just saw Deadpool 2. And I saw Avengers Infinity War twice, and a new Star Wars movie is coming out, so it's a pretty good time for fans, except when it comes to fans of FanX, the Salt Lake Comic Convention, formerly known as Salt Lake Comic Con. So let's go back in time a bit to the source of a controversy that has continued to unfold over this past week. Richard Paul Evans is a Utah author who is really popular here, and he's having a bit of a Me Too moment now.
He's having a rather sizable Me Too moment. This whole mishigas started with Richard Paul Evans last September was accused by a female author of inappropriate physical contact. Went in for a hug, went in for a kiss, in a way that she felt was intimidating and definitely unwanted. He tried to brush it off as, oh, I just hug. I'm a hugger. I do that all the time. And I was in Italy for a couple years, so I kiss people on the cheeks all the time too.
Last September, was this at the last
This was
Comic-Con?
at the last Salt Lake Comic Con when this happened. She filed a formal complaint with the organizers in October, and they took their time following up on it. Finally talked to Evans about it, not until January, as we found out from the timeline. And handled it in a way that a lot of people, including a good chunk of the Utah writing community, good Utah authors, which include a lot of nationally known authors, thought was dismissive and sort of dragging their feet on the whole thing, and playing into sort of the good old boy network of this. And so a couple authors were writing and commenting back and forth to Brian Brandenburg and Dan Farr, the founders of FanX, what's now called FanX, thanks to the lawsuit last year. We're saying, okay, what are you going to do about this? And why is your response so lacking? And the last straw happened early this week, over the weekend, when Brandenburg responded to Utah author Shannon Hale,
who's pretty popular.
Who's very
well,
popular.
Yeah.
She's a Princess in Black series, Princess Academy, Austin Land, currently writing Squirrel Girl books for Marvel. And you don't mess
How
with
exciting.
You don't mess with Squirrel Girl. This is
breaking
the thing.
News here.
her second book is just coming out in the Squirrel Girl series. Anyway, and the response to Hale was, quote, "Maybe you should sit this one out."
Yeah, I want to get into that.
Yeah.
But first of all, why was Shannon compelled to get involved and throw her voice into this?
Because she is a prominent voice, and I mean, she was not personally, she says, not personally affected by this. She was not assaulted. She was not harassed in any way. But she feels that she has a voice because of her level of popularity amongst writers. That she felt she could, get somewhere that maybe a lesser writer could not, and there is a group of writers that have been on top of this issue. They've been trying to get some positive action out of the FANEX people for a while and have been very frustrated that the response has been dismissive and, as the last email to Shannon shows, rather condescending and what Shannon referred to as sexist bingo. Because it's like every cliche you could think of was in this email. The I have four daughters. Yeah. Me too. You know, I was doing this before it became trendy with the Me Too movement. All these things, and so Shannon took that little block of text without attributing it, posted it on Twitter, so everybody could see what was going on. Did not mention FANEX by name. Did not mention Brandenburg by name.
She just mentioned that this was a convention.
Having this dialogue with a convention, and this is what they sent me, and the bombshell, and of course everybody went what, and was very shocked that this sort of thing would happen. Brandenburg countered by posting the entire email stream on Twitter, which included Shannon's private email address. Which the term there is doxing, which is a form of online harassment. He said it was accidental. It was a moment of passion and so on. And he deleted the tweet pretty quickly, or fairly quickly after realizing what had happened. But damage was done. This blew up into a bigger thing.
So you said that, you know, these writers were looking for some action from the people at FANEX, but they did create an anti-harassment policy from
right.
some of this. Can you kind of explain what that looks like? And also, if there was a policy before addressing this, what did that look like?
The push was not just to do something about Richard Paul Evans specifically, which has happened. He is not coming to FANEX this September, and in the most recent statement, not coming ever again. That was the statement yesterday after Brian Brandenburg stepped aside.
We'll get to that too.
We haven't even gotten to yet.
This
thing has had so many moving parts in the last three or four days.
Right.
It's gone very quickly. The group called Rock Canyon Writers, which are Utah authors who are nationally prominent in the kid lit and the young adult fields. That's a lot of people. That's people like Ali Condie, that's Shannon Hale, that's a bunch of others. Used to be James Dashner before he was shown the door, metaphorically, after harassment charges last fall. Or February, pardon me. The pledge that they came up with was not did not mention FANEX by name. It said, we as writers will not go to any more conventions that do not have a clear, concise and enforceable policy against sexual harassment, and it did not mention FANEX by name, but it's very clear that's directly who they were aiming at. FANEX has come up with in the last couple of weeks a anti-harassment policy that they started to shop around and started to sort of workshop. Finally released a more solid version of it this week, after all the commotion over Shannon Hale's tweet right. and the doxing. They also put in place a new communications manager, Amanda Bull, who has been trying to ride herd over all this and take the reins back of the social media, which is the other issue, is that Brian Brandenburg tends to be very reactive and get on social media and just spout things, which then get him in trouble.
Or post email correspondence,
right? Right, and
with
and
Utah authors,
and so he, so they said he would step aside from he issued an apology afterwards to Shannon Hale and to everybody else late Monday, and then the announcement was that he would step aside from social media. After that announcement, he got on a private FANEX related Facebook account to argue more. And of course, which got out because Twitter, because
it's the internet,
because screen grabs and Twitter and the internet and everything's going to get seen eventually, at where he seemed to be further defending Richard Paul Evans and slamming Shannon Hale. Then yesterday afternoon, Brian Brandenburg announced he would be taking an extended leave of absence from FANEX.
Okay.
So that's where we are now. Although we don't know how long extended is. Dan Farr last night said he hopes that Brian will be back in time for the September event, which raises the question: well, what good is a leave of absence if he's still going to be there on the actual event.
Okay.
So.
All right. It's time to bring Holly Richardson in here for this. Pull a mic on over. Holly, there are a lot of things to unpack here. And you said before the show that you've kind of been following Shannon Hale's Twitter. But first of all, we have talked in the past about the Me Too movement. Brandenburg says he has daughters, he has a wife. But do you think he gets it?
Well, clearly he doesn't get it, right? And neither does Richard Paul Evans, who keeps digging his hole deeper.
We haven't even talked about that part.
Right? So,
more to come.
So I think that's one of the things that's unfortunate with the Me Too movement. And we've talked in the past about potential backlash, right? So as women come forward and say, this is not okay, this has been happening to me, and collectively there's this movement, there's also a backlash. And it seems that in some quarters, it's easy to kind of dig in your heels and say, well, because I have daughters, I know that it's not a problem, or because I know this person, right? It's in some ways, it's almost a token. Well, I knew this one person this one time, and I liked her okay, so it's not a problem for me. So, it's been interesting to watch on Twitter. It's been interesting to watch Shannon's Twitter feed. She's not backing down. And one of the things that I saw yesterday, you mentioned Manda, Shannon posted that the social media for FanX had been, the Twitter at least, had been taken over by a woman, by Manda, and please don't harass her, is what she said. She's trying to make it better, so don't go after her. This is not the same person. So I thought that was kind of great, and so did Manda, because she responded and said thank you.
Well, what do you think a policy that works and actually addresses this issue would even look like?
Look, I think one of them is you just have to start to be clear about what's okay and what's not okay, right? I mean, I'm a huggy person too, but I don't think I would impose myself on someone who didn't want to hug me, for one thing, and then I wouldn't continue to say, oh, well, I went to Italy. Well, I was raised in France for three of my teenage years, and I'm huggy and kissy also. But I think there should be just reasonable standards, which is there's no unwanted physical attention. And one of the other problems as well was calling her pretty, right? Was looking at her. And it's not bad to compliment someone, but when you're doing it in a way that makes people feel uncomfortable, associated with physical contact, hugging and kissing, that's a problem, right? And so I think just basically having some standard that says no unwanted physical contact, right? Be sensitive, be aware of what you're doing.
Just ask, I guess.
Yeah,
right?
you can ask. Yeah, you can ask, but I think I don't think it's that hard.
Well, Sean,
my colleague Rachel Piper, we've been writing several of these stories together. She's interviewed experts, professors, and so on, and the upshot is, if you want a case study on how not to do this, FanX is going to be written up in textbooks for ages as the exact wrong steps to take in dealing with any sort of harassment or PR nightmare issues this.
There will be classes about
crisis
this.
Communication, right? Is you just stop digging, right? And they just made it worse and made it worse and made it worse and made it worse.
Where's Kerry Washington when you need her? You know, that's,
That's a scandal reference.
That's a scandal reference.
Well, Sean,
if we could get her on FanX, that would be great.
Yeah. Talking about, digging in and really, I guess, like sticking to your guns, things got even messier when Richard Paul Evans responded to the Shannon Hale situation in an interview with Chris Jones from Channel
Right.
2.
Well, I mean, first off, he has said, Richard Paul Evans said he was repulsed by the accusations against him, because there was a second case that Rachel had a source uncovered, but he said he was repulsed by the accusations. But then on the first one, he acknowledged pretty much everything that happened. But he said, he said that he hugged her and said you're so pretty, and so on. But he says I was trying to lift her up, which of course is not his call to make. It's like he may think that's what's happening, but you're not allowed. It's up to her to decide what is the actual what's happening. Yeah, he went on TV and said that white men are being persecuted in all this, and this is all part of a campaign by feminists to wipe out the white male as we know it, and he compared white males, quote, like Jews in Nazi Germany,
In what way?
Let's give us some context. Well, he later started to apologize, tried to apologize for what he said was a stupid comparison, but then he said it was, well, not like during the war, but like before the war, the pre-Holocaust day. I can't even begin to fathom what he thought he was saying in all this. But, you know, Godwin's law, which is, you know, and any argument will eventually turn to Nazis, was definitely in full effect here. And not to Mr. Evans's credit. So he's been trying to backtrack from that. His publishers in New York are notably silent on the issue at the moment. They don't want to comment at all. But he has dug himself in this hole. And, you know, we forget that, you know, for all of the Christmas box and sweetness and light sort of stories that he tells, and the Michael Vay series of young adult science fiction that he writes, he's also very heavily into this whole men's rights thing and the men. You know, he created this group called
Tribe of Kings,
which is some sort of clubhouse down in Murray or someplace.
Can women join?
Apparently not.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I don't think you'd enjoy it,
Holly.
I don't think I'd enjoy it.
So Robert Gehrke had a column this week talking about geek culture and what's going on with Fan X, and he kind of brought it back to, I guess, women not being very visible in this realm of things in the past. I don't know, Sean, I feel like you probably have some thoughts on that. But Holly, I guess I want to talk about this Me Too backlash. And it seems like, you know, of course, we're seeing more women out in the world and in these spaces that have been traditionally occupied by men. Is this just, I don't know, the growing pains that we're seeing for men who don't know what to do with this situation?
So one of the statements that I keep seeing is that when you are used to being dominant, equality feels like oppression, right? So when women are now becoming equal, some men are feeling like they're oppressed and like they're being picked on because we have leveled the playing field a little bit more. And I think there's some truth in that. Right, I think there's some truth in that, and to the point with Richard Paul Evans, where he was comparing men to Jews in Nazi Germany, he actually had another statement where he said, "Well, I know there's women out there who say we only need 10% of men, right? We can get rid of the rest, and just keep 10% of them around." Well, I think that's clearly an analogy that would go towards gas chambers and extermination, which is just mind-boggling that somebody would even go there, but. But yeah, I mean, I think that is what we're seeing, and I think from my perspective, what I see, not only with FanX and things like that, and I've got a number of people that I know that are women that are involved in that, but across the board, we're seeing women who feel braver at speaking up. They're feeling empowered to speak up at work, to tell somebody that their touch is unwanted. I just saw it with a group of friends this week, somebody who had somebody really handsy at work, and she actually excused herself from a meeting, went out, kind of role played in her head, went back in. When the meeting was concluded, she looked him in the eye and she said, "You just did this to me. It did not feel comfortable. I don't like it. Don't do it again." Oh. And she herself said, "I would never have done that before. I felt like there were other people who had my back."
Well, Sean, we're going to wrap this segment, but really quickly, I wanted to ask you about the public's response to all of this. And I don't know, is there going to be a FanX in September?
I think there still will be a FanX in September. What shape it takes is going to be very interesting. Because within the community, there's a lot of discussion and griping. I mean, just over the last few hours since Brian's announcement yesterday, you look on the Facebook and Twitter and so on, you have some people complaining about social justice warriors, you know, feminazis and all that stuff, you know, destroying FanX and as we know it and so on. But you also have a lot of people saying, okay, this is a first step toward trying to improve it. The other thing I want to say that you hear from the community is that this is another example of the sort of arrogance and hubris that Dan and Brian have exhibited over the years. You look at how they drove a sports car with the Salt Lake Comic Con logo into San Diego Comic Con, poking the bear of the big thing, which is sort of what led to the copyright infringement lawsuit. You had last year an incident where Brandenburg wanted to bring in Orson Scott Card, the author, who is known for his anti-LGBT beliefs, and how Brandenburg thought he could be the great peacemaker, and he basically got told, no, this is not your part, not your role. And so you do have this issue where they do have this level of sort of arrogance and thinking they know what's best, and some in the community really don't like.
Yeah. Well, I guess whatever happens to FanX, the geek culture will persist.
You can't knock them down.
You can't stop those Utah nerds. All right, we're going to move into our next segment after a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about the LDS Church's meeting with civil rights organization, the NAACP. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community. This is Behind the Headlines. I'm Emily Means with KCPW. I'm joined in studio by Salt Lake Tribune columnist Holly Richardson and reporters Peggy Fletcher-Stack, Sean P. Means, and Lee Davidson. And don't forget, you can join our conversation by calling 801-355-8255. And Peggy, it's been a busy week, couple of weeks for you.
Yes, it has.
Let's talk about this meeting between church leaders and NAACP officials. It was a big deal from what I understand. This is a global church and the nation's oldest civil rights organization. So how did it happen?
Well, it's pretty fascinating. It's an important year, 40 years after an announcement that the LDS Church was discontinuing its ban on black men and boys in its all-male priesthood and women and girls, and it's barred from going to Mormon temples. June 8th, 1978 was just a huge day for this LDS Church ending that ban. Back then, the NAACP, as you say, the nation's oldest, most prominent civil rights black activist group, protested that ban, marched on Temple Square, tried to have meetings with the church leaders, were not able to do so back then, were kind of seen as the enemy. Now we are 40 years later, and they are not only meeting with, in a private meeting or something, with the LDS Church first presidency, not just lower down officials, but they are issuing a sort of joint statement. I mean, they each had their own statements calling for civility and racial harmony, suggesting joint projects. Pretty important. And there's will be lots of other celebrations, commemorations of that event, the 40th anniversary of that. But this one was a big one.
Yeah, and it seems to have come about from, I don't know, an unlikely friendship.
Exactly, which it wasn't even on anyone's radar till late last fall, which is, by Mormon standards, a very short turnaround time. Which is, what happened was, in Jackson, Mississippi, there was some kind of joint service project cleaning up the Medgar Evers Convention Center, or the office center in Mississippi. And a guy named Wilbur Collum, who is with the NAACP in Jackson, noted that and reached out to his longtime white Mormon friend in Salt Lake City and said, hey, maybe we could, you know, collaborate on some things. And maybe we could, what would you say to meeting with the top officials of both organizations? The two put their heads together. Steve Hill, the Utah Mormon, reached out to his contacts in the LDS Church, and in 2 weeks it was put together, which, as I said, that's pretty fast. by Mormon standards, but you know, it was a historic, important meeting for them. It was last Thursday held in the LDS Church Administration Building. President of the LDS Church, Russell Nelson, gave his statement, and then Derek Johnson, the NAACP president, gave a similar statement. It was all carried live on in the media.
Yeah.
So, well, it was
us,
a big deal.
Tell us about those statements, and I guess what did they accomplish at this meeting?
Well, it was mostly symbolic. I think the statements were pretty broad and general, and unfortunately, just as they were meeting, just before they started meeting, a former Mormon put out a fake apology statement, you know, acting as if he were Russell Nelson and apologizing for the LDS Church's past racial policies, and that became a viral message for a while. Black Mormons believed it, and then when they found out it was fake, their hopes were dashed and they were furious. It was a pretty cruel hoax for them. This week that prankster has apologized for his actions. I guess he underestimated the pain it would cause. He apologized, but Black Mormons as a group didn't think the apology was adequate. So
yeah,
unfortunately, it's sort of that event a little bit overshadowed the historic nature of the meeting itself.
So they talked about collaborating on different humanitarian efforts and education, but I guess there are no concrete plans yet?
No, they did talk. They were in a couple of days of meetings, and they talked about some three areas, like humanitarian projects, education, and the NAACP said that the LDS Church's leaders offered its online education program, which made me smile. They said, "We'll help you take Mormonism out of it and put Martin Luther King in it." So I thought that was...
I don't know what that means exactly.
That was pretty cool. And education, humanitarian things, and just outreach. So there are some concrete proposals. I don't know that they didn't announce any actual plans.
So like you mentioned, we're coming up on the 40th anniversary of the end of that prohibition on Black people entering the priesthood and temples. And I think that's really interesting that this has coincided with that. And I'm sure you're working on something.
Yes.
For that upcoming anniversary. But maybe you can talk about how Black Mormons have responded to this meeting of these two organizations. And are they connecting it to the revelation or the church's policy? In any way?
As far as I can tell, the Black Mormons I've talked to were happy to see the statements, but of course wished for more specificity, and yeah, absolutely wanted an apology or some kind of acknowledgement of the pain they suffered for many, many decades, right up to the present. Many of them continue to experience racial slurs by fellow Mormons and discrimination and mistreatment. They have wanted a little bit stronger statements about that. Although the LDS Church last summer after the Charlottesville,
right,
condemned white supremacy in no uncertain terms in among members. So that was a good statement. So Black Mormons, I think, are excited about this. These events, this anniversary, I'm vastly generalizing here, but they would like to see more action in terms of asking white members to be more sensitive, more aware, less bigoted, less racist. And I think they're happy to commemorate the event. It was a big change in many lives, but not enough.
Well, Holly, let's bring you in here. Do you think this meeting reflects growing diversity in the LDS Church, which I think historically has largely been considered a white church?
Yeah, I'm sure Peggy has the stats better than I do, but I believe that we have more members now outside of the United States than we do within, and English is no longer the dominant language, I mean, I think worldwide. So I've been all over the world. I've been to LDS church meetings all over the world, and I have sons that I've sent on LDS missions, and half of them have gone to Africa. So I also am the white mother of black children, who they were adopted from Africa. They don't have the African-American part because they're American citizens now, but they were actually born in Africa. But I think there is a growing diversity within the church worldwide, but I also think that there's recognition that there are things that were done in the past that were not right. They were maybe signs of those times and reflective of attitudes of those times, but not correct. And I think, not to spend too much time on it, but I think that's why the fake apology hurt so much, is because people recognize that there's a need for that, and that there were things that were said that were racist and that still are, right? My kids have gotten it as well. And they get it. I've written about racism in Utah, and we'd love to think that we're above it, but we're not. But I think it's great. And every step we take forward is a good step, right? And I know I'm appreciative of the meeting with the NAACP. I mean, I think getting the two groups together at the top level, I think that's really indicative of trying to make changes. And, you know, here's something with President Nelson. He's 93 years old. He must know he doesn't have a ton of time, right? And he is amazing. To me, he's been amazing at the pace that he's willing to go. And I think at being willing to just go right to the heart of some of these really, really tough issues and say, we're going to do better from here on out.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting. Peggy, the last time you were on the show, we talked about President Nelson, you know, becoming the new prophet of the church. And I think many people seem to think, given his history, he's very traditional and conservative. But this is fairly progressive. What's your read on that?
Yeah, I mean, we don't know exactly all that he's going to do. But yes, this is symbolic. And as Holly says, kind of hit the ground running. We wonder if it's because of the sense of not a lot of time.
He's very healthy, though, right? I think we talked about that extensively.
93 is the new 63, baby.
Pretty obnoxiously healthy, yeah. So, this is an important, as I said, symbolic meeting. And also, if actual collaborations emerge, then it will be more than symbolic. So it's I don't know that all the we know everything that President Nelson will do, and he does come out of a fairly traditional past, and he is 93, so he was definitely around when that ban existed. Whether, you know, the celebration, the commemoration will be next Friday, a week from today, in the conference center, and I have heard that he is asked to speak, so I think we'll know more after we hear that speech.
Can I ask you really quickly about this celebration?
Yeah.
It's interesting to me that they're having this huge event to commemorate the 40-year anniversary. 40 years wasn't that long ago.
Yeah.
Is there still, I don't know, some pain there too.
Oh, totally.
And does anyone feel kind of weird about celebrating this?
There's plenty of people who are concerned about using the term celebration, and others defend the term as being important. Honestly, people celebrated the end of slavery for sure. So celebrating the end of a ban does feel right to some black members, but because of continued pain, others will say, no, I don't want to go. I don't want to use the word celebration. And I want more, not just from the NAACP and church statement, but as Holly says, that it would mean a lot to members if the church leaders would speak to those decades of pain for sure.
Well, I was looking at the comments section like I do. Why? Why do I do that? I'm not quite sure. But a lot of people kind of brought this back to well, present day and LGBTQ people in the church. And President Nelson made this statement about, you know, all human beings being made equal in the eyes of God, and you know, something to that sentiment. Do you think that this opens the door to different partnerships and collaborations, like with LGBTQ organizations? What do you think, Holly or Peggy?
Well, certainly. I mean, I think that every step that the church is taking right now is trying to look at current issues, right? I've been pretty outspoken about some of their missteps in the Me Too movement within the church, but there are also some signs that they've taken that really seriously. And then the next incident was handled a lot better. So the LGBTQ community, yeah, sure. I'm sure there are. And I know that Tom Christofferson has been a big part of that, right? Elder Christofferson's brother, who is gay and who is outspoken and saying, you know, look, here's things that we can do together. So to your point with Steve Hill.
Mm-hmm.
His daughter lives in my neighborhood, and she has been instrumental in Circle with the LGBT community down in our area.
Advocacy group.
Yeah. So it's really interesting, right? They're a family of advocates.
And the church also endorsed last summer the Love Loud concert, which was pretty startling when the church did that. So that's a collaboration, sort of an endorsement of. So people are seeing what they would call baby steps.
Well, Peggy, we'll have to check in with you after that celebration in a couple of weeks, but we're going to go to a quick break. When we come back, another eventful meeting of the Utah Republican Party and your underplayed stories of the week. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Emily Means with KCPW, and I've got the Salt Lake Tribune's Holly Richardson, Peggy Fletcher-Stack, Sean P. Means, and Lee Davidson in the studio with me. And Lee, you've been waiting patiently to talk about one of my favorite topics in Utah politics. Last weekend, you got the glamorous assignment to cover a meeting by the Utah GOP's State Central Committee. And we have talked about the state of the state GOP often on this show, but maybe you can describe really quickly what the State Central Committee is, why they meet, you know, why they meet and why they met this time, and why there's a divide in the party. Just the spark notes.
And this meeting did turn into kind of a three-ring circus, and we'll talk about that. But the State Central Committee is huge. It has 183 members, or did. And it consists of elected officials, chairmen of the different counties, people who are elected specifically to the committee, and representatives of some auxiliaries to the committee. And some of these, I'll just kind of jump into what happened here. There's a lot of party infighting going on between conservatives and moderates.
But all Republicans still.
But all Republicans. And we can get into the reasons behind that, but just bear in mind that there's this infighting going on.
Okay.
And as part of that, the Central Committee ended up suspending and ejecting temporarily some minority members and women members. There's some controversy over some party auxiliaries, like the Utah Republican Latino Coalition, Black Republicans, Utah Federated Women. And some party members wondered if they're actually really legitimate groups. They're supposed to have activities every quarter. They're supposed to have significant numbers. Some party members contend that they don't do that, and they're just kind of there in name only so that they can send people to the Central Committee and have a voice.
So these are just different groups that are associated with the party, with
right.
the state party.
They represent different caucuses within the party. And so some members wanted them suspended until there could be a further investigation into whether they're real or not. And because this involves some minorities and women. For example, there's a member named Carolina Heron, who's a native of Brazil. And she yelled out during the debate, so debate. So I can't vote because I'm Hispanic and a woman. And another member sitting next to her yelled out, saying, "This isn't about discrimination. It's about our party rules." So I call BS on the race card. He didn't say BS. He said the longer version of it.
Thank you. We're on the radio, Lee.
Right. And so Carolina yelled back at him, "I call BS on you." And that's the kind of meeting it was.
Okay.
But it ended up that they did suspend these auxiliaries.
But they
and
hadn't
then they
thought to do
out.
This before, right?
Well, they have talked about it for months. And for different reasons, it didn't happen. And so, but this time it did. And moderates especially were saying, look at the optics here. You know, you're kicking out minorities and women. What does this look like?
And, it looks like just what it is.
Right.
Let's just be honest.
Okay. And so the vote happened. They were temporarily suspended. And the chair said, sorry, you have to pick up and go. And they did. And some of these people are driven from places like St. George and whatnot.
Okay. So that was one thing that happened at this meeting. There was also a new vice chair elected. Maybe you can talk about what happened to the old vice chair and who was in the running this time.
Well, there were a lot of people running for vice chair. At one point, there were 24 of them. Many of them dropped out to try to consolidate who they were pushing. But by the time the vote came around, there were 13 in the race. There was one woman. She happened to win. Name's Kara Berkland, and she's with the conservative wing of the party. And actually, all the moderates were out in the first round. They were gone. But also not helping their optics is there were three black members running. They all lost.
Including former party chair James Evans.
Right, who did make it to the final round. He finished in second, essentially. And the current chairman, named Rob Anderson, won by contending that Evans was bankrupting the party with a lawsuit against a new law about how elections are held.
SB 54.
SB 54.
Kind of what all of this is about, right?
Right. That law allows candidates to qualify for the ballot either by collecting signatures or using the traditional caucus convention system. Conservatives like the caucus convention system. Most delegates are more conservative, and so they see that as giving them more power. And moderates say it tends to nominate people who are outside the political mainstream. And so they like being able to qualify by collecting signatures, saying it gives people more choice, and hence the moderate conservative fights in large part.
Lee, do you think what does this new vice chair mean for Rob Anderson? You said she's quite conservative. Is it her intention to serve as a counter to him?
She did not say that. She said she's just trying to heal the party and bring everyone together. But everyone was saying that, including James Evans.
Holly is ready to comment. I'm going to come to you in a minute, Holly.
The current party secretary and current party vice chairwoman are very much in the conservative wing of the party. Rob Anderson's more in the moderate wing, as is the treasurer, I believe. They're the top four. But, yeah, the party's kind of splitting apart, and it's constantly fighting. The Central Committee took power away from Rob Anderson to control the lawsuit challenging this election law. So they set up their own little committee that decides how they're going to proceed, and Rob Anderson has no say on that currently.
Okay. Well, Holly, let's talk optics. You're involved with the party. What does it look like for you to have these different groups removed?
Look, I mean, I think it looks just like everybody else thinks it looks. It looks like the Republican Party is the old white guy party, and that doesn't want anybody else in the party. It doesn't want minorities. It doesn't want women. And it surely doesn't want people who disagree with this little, small, very loud group. So I think the optics are terrible. I'm not surprised at the outcome in the election. I'm also not surprised at them kicking out anybody who would potentially disagree with them. I think one of the reasons they got rid of the auxiliaries is because they do tend to be on the more centrist side. I wouldn't even say moderate, but center right. Right? They're more rational, maybe. And Lee's very, very nice. I'm not maybe quite as nice. But what I see is now a new vice chair who has said she is determined to continue with this lawsuit that is has dragged on now forever. They've lost at every single stage. They continue to want to pursue it. They're not going to win. And in the meantime, you've just got damage all the way down the ticket, right? There's so many people now who have disaffiliated from the party. They don't want to be involved. They're not going to be voting in primaries. I mean, it's gotten to the point where it's just absurd.
So I guess this is why this story is so interesting to me, because, you know, the Republicans have a super majority in this state. But it seems that with all of these different stories of, you know, discontent among each other, that just will alienate people from the party. Is that your read on it?
It absolutely does. And I have, in fact, I have some really good friends who have been registered Republicans for ever since they were 18 years old, who have unaffiliated. And they haven't chosen to affiliate with another party, but they are just like, I just can't do this anymore. I can't do it. And I don't blame them, right? The optics are horrible. The idea that we used to be the party of the big tent, and now we want to shrink it as a Republican party so that only the purest of the pure can be part of this little inner circle, it's ridiculous. There's 600,000 registered Republicans, and you've got 180 something, say slightly over half of that, who are trying to control everything from ballot access to finances to lawsuits. It's just dumb.
Well, we're about to move into our underplayed stories, but Lee, what comes out of this Central Committee meeting? What do they talk about at their next meeting?
Well, they have a lot of resolutions and bylaw changes to try to each side punish the other that they didn't get to because they wasted all their time fighting on all the other stuff. So that'll come up in August. So there's more fighting on the horizon.
All right. Well, we're going to go to our underplayed stories of the week. Holly, I know you have one ready. Go ahead.
I do have one ready, and I think this is a story that's going to get legs. Tommy Burr of the Tribune reported yesterday that Ron Mortenson in Utah has been tapped to serve as the Assistant Secretary of State over population, refugees, and migration. The problem with that is Ron Mortenson is an extreme hardliner anti-immigrant person. So he's, I've known him for many, many years. He's part of a group called the Center for Immigration Studies, which sounds really innocuous, but it's also been named as a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. And then he co-founded the Utah Coalition on Illegal Immigration, also fairly innocuous, but it's designed to point out all the bad things about immigration. And I think this story is underplayed, but I think it will gain legs. And my hope is there's enough pressure on the senators from the state of Utah, both Hatch and Lee, that they can exert pressure on their colleagues and not confirm this appointment. I think it's a horrible, horrible mistake.
Yeah, we'll have to watch what happens there, especially since Utahns are very friendly to immigrants and refugees.
Traditionally.
Yeah. Sean, do you have one?
Well, if you had $10,000 to spend, you might pay a year of your kids' college tuition or pay off your car loan or go on a cruise or something. The new AC Hotel in downtown Salt Lake City, they bought a prosciutto slicer.
Oh, my goodness. That's a great story. My mom would love that.
This thing apparently slices prosciutto so thin, quote, it almost melts in your mouth. Kathy Stevenson writing about it. So if you want to have your prosciutto on a molecular level, apparently this is the place to go.
Wow.
Kathy's got that story in today's mix, and it'll be, and it's online.
That's great. Thank you so much to Kathy for doing that important reporting. All right, Peggy, you have a story.
Yes, I was interested that neighbors in Sugar House are complaining about the possibility of a home for a hospice center for homeless coming into their neighborhood, and I happen to live pretty close to that, so I just do not understand the opposition. 13th East and 13th South is where it's actually a little bit down on 13th South. So it's pretty typical, not in my neighborhood stuff.
Yeah, a story that's actually close to home for you.
It is.
All right, Lee?
This one's about the Utah Transit Authority again. Most people wouldn't want to be fired. But former president and CEO Jerry Benson this week had his lawyer go to the board and threaten to sue them if they didn't fire him again. They had fired him last month, but they violated the Utah open meetings law when they did it. And so they had to redo their firing. And they were considering not doing it, but but that would have thrown into question whether he got his $282,000 severance. And he wanted that, and so
lawyers threatened him. Well, I can't blame him.
Right, and it's a big, complicated mess. But in short, they fired him again. He's got his big severance package. So.
All right, thanks for that, Lee. And for my part, my friend Courtney Tanner wrote a story about the former Google executive who's offering up $1 million to the Utahn who can save middle class. So anyone can submit a proposal. You just have to increase the income of 10,000 middle class households by at least 10% in the next 2 years. So seems easy enough. The proposals are due August 30th. Holly Richardson, Peggy Fletcher Stack, Sean P. Means, and Lee Davidson, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
It was
thank
fun.
You.
I had a great time. Yes. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, to the people at Utah Public Radio, and also to Roger McDonough, who will be back next week. And thank you for tuning in. You can find podcasts of this program at kcpw.org, on iTunes, or however you get your podcasts. You can also catch up with KCPW on Facebook at kcpw88.3. Up next on KCPW Presents, the story of German prisoners of war from World War II who were sent to America. I'm Emily Means. Have a wonderful holiday weekend.